Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Speaking today with Sam Williams, he's the author of Arguing AI, The Battle for 21st Century Science. He's a writer for Upside Today. Welcome, Sam.
Yeah, welcome. Thank you.
Your book is wonderful and short, mercifully short, Introduction to Artificial Intelligence, and you start with the progenitors of the theory of artificial intelligence, David Hilbert and Alan Turing. The rest of your book is given over to a discussion of Ray Kurzweil, Jaron Lanier, and Bill Joy as examples of the different parts of the terrain right now about the argument about the future of AI and whether it's going to be a good thing or not. Ray Kurzweil's got a beautiful website up. I'm sure you've seen it, the KurzweilAI.net, where he is really avidly pursuing building his own kind of mini social movement.
And,
and he is calling him an optimist is a bit of an understatement. Isn't it?
Yeah, I would say he's almost, there's a definite spiritual component to his optimism. You know, he really thinks that we're going through the singularity within the next 5 to 25 years, and he's optimistic, kind of like a Christian is optimistic about the rapture. It's going to be scary for everybody else, but it'll be good for Ray Kurzweil.
Well, he thinks that we'll be able to have many robotic computers inside our brains, which will interface us all in real time and create virtual environments and give us control over our emotions, our memory, the structures of our brains, and ultimately our bodies as well. So it really is a very comprehensive set of transformations in the nature of life that he foresees coming out of this.
Yeah, he's a true believer in Moore's Law, the notion that, microchip, transistor densities are increasing at an exponential rate, which, if you work that out, that basically means that computers are getting twice as fast every 2 years. Transistor sizes are getting twice as small. So he says if this trend holds up, it's not very hard to envision computers that are small enough to fit in your bloodstream, computers that can sit on your desk that have the raw processing power of the human brain. Whether they can function like a brain is another whole other argument. But the whole concept that eventually you build enough transistors and you sort of hit this critical mass and intelligence kind of walks out of your system.
Don't you think that Moore's Law has a lot of legs to it?
A lot of legs. What do you mean by legs?
Well, it seems to have been, Kurzweil and his website, he has these charts that show the evolution from the abacus right on up and evolution of all kinds of energy, production, et cetera, and shows various non-linear geometric trends in all of these things. So at least with Moore's Law, this geometric doubling of computer power seems to be going on for at least the next 20 years.
Yeah, that's the other one thing that makes him unique is that, everybody's an exaggeration, but lots of writers have been dealing with Moore's Law, especially in the last 5 to 10 years. I think how quickly the internet and the World Wide Web, as a subset of the internet, just exploded on the scene in the mid-90s has really made a lot of people believers that technology can bring us very, very far, very fast. But what Kurzweil has done is he's gone back and kind of, shaken up the parameters a little bit, and he's traced back to, like you said, back to the abacus, back to the Hollerith tabulator back in 1900, the first kind of pre-computer machines of the 1930s and 40s. And he says, if you look at raw processing power, you will notice that Moore's Law is really just kind of, what we use to describe the last 30 to 40 years of this trend. This trend's been going back to Charles Babbage in the 19th century. We're just machines that are built to process information are just getting exponentially faster and faster and faster. And every time the machines get faster, they facilitate the development of even more intelligent machines. Intelligence is the wrong word. They facilitate the development of more efficient, faster machines. And then, intelligence is just the software that runs atop those machines.
I'm speaking with Sam Williams. He's the author of Arguing AI, The Battle for 21st Century Science. Now, Jaron Lanier is definitely the most colorful of the people you talk about. He's a dreadlocked white guy who was one of the inventors of virtual reality, the first virtual reality rigs.
Yeah.
And he made a big splash a couple years ago with his half-baked manifesto. Was it half-baked or half a manifesto?
One half a manifesto.
One half a manifesto.
Yeah.
What did he say in that?
He basically said, you know, Kurzweil, Moravec, you know, a lot of these people that are very, believers in that artificial intelligence is just going to manifest itself in about 20 to 30 years. He just said, I can't take it anymore. I have to step up and take these people on. And his primary argument was that, sure, you look at Moore's Law, the machines are getting faster. But if you look at the software is just getting buggier, more complex with each generation. Compare, Microsoft Windows to a Microsoft MS-DOS of the 1980s. It's just, you're just layering it with more widgets, more bells and whistles. And, the people that are talking about this kind of singularity and artificial intelligence by 2020, human-style intelligence and machines, they're just really not looking at the software side of the problem. And, he's not the only one arguing it, but he seemed to do it the most eloquently in that article. And the one statement that he had that really just grabbed me was, that artificial intelligence is best understood as a belief system, not as a science. And that shook me up because that was an argument that they made back in the late 60s, early 70s. And it really surprised me that argument was still... people were still giving voice to that argument, especially after the Deep Blue victory in 1997.
Well, he's also critical of what he calls cybernetic totalism, right? He thinks that there's a comprehensive ideology out there that Kurzweil's definitely a part of.
Yeah.
And what is cybernetic totalism?
That's his attempt to coin a term. I mean, I don't know. I was looking at one of your papers before I came here, the one on the politics of transhumanism. Right. And I think that's his attempt to group the transhumanist people, the people that are just talking about this from a political angle, that, mankind is augmenting itself and kind of going through its own Moore's Law evolution and connecting it with the actual scientists and technologists who are giving fuel to these people, people like Moravec, who's a scientist at Carnegie Mellon, and Kurzweil, who is a fairly... well-respected engineer with a very solid track record in terms of bringing technology to the marketplace. And he's just trying to, this whole cybernetic totalist is kind of a way to group all these different people that are kind of building this bandwagon that everybody's jumping onto right now.
Now, the most startling of all of the apostates from cybernetic totalism or the transhumanist vision was definitely Bill Joy and his mm-hmm. manifesto published in Wired, which was also definitely an attention-grabbing place to publish it.
Yeah.
Bill Joy basically thinks the world's going to hell in a handbasket and we need to have a global total ban on AI research as well as genetic research and robotics research. Is that fair?
I don't know if that's fair to say. When I talked to him, I mentioned that he says that he kind of gets depicted as a pessimist. He's not a pessimist, but one of his arguments was that he didn't really want to call for a ban. He just wanted to call for a couple things. One was the sort of ethical recognition within the scientific community that this whole idea that we're not in control of what we create. We're just scientists. We're just working. And if somebody uses our knowledge for ill ends, like to create a harmful strain of bacteria or to create a weapon or to create a, robot that kind of gets out of control, it's just not good enough, especially after the 20th century when you had the guys after the Hiroshima bombing saying, man, if we knew that that was going to happen, we would have approached this a little bit differently. He's arguing, one, for a sort of Hippocratic oath within the scientific community to first do no harm. And then secondly, he's arguing for a little bit more oversight, not necessarily governmental oversight. One of his things that he said to me was that he would be in favor of kind of an insurance solution to research that might result in these kind of weapons of mass destruction and rogue technology. technologies, you know, that sort of like, you know, you can work on nanotechnology, but you're going to have to pay the insurance that is going to regulate that these technologies don't go out of control. It's like, I don't know, kind of reminds me of the Turing police and William Gibson's Neuromancer, but I don't know. Those were the two arguments that he kind of drilled into me, and I tried to put both of those in the book.
Seems like insurance for the possibility of destroying the world with a rogue technology is an order of magnitude and an inappropriate response to the threat. I mean, if the threat is what he describes it as, and I think a lot of the transhumanists take that the threat of rogue nanotechnology at least very seriously.
Yeah, when I say insurance, I'm kind of I'm really putting a shorthand reference on what he said. I think what he was talking about is sort of a market solution to this. It's like, you know, a lot of people saw that essay, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, and they say, well, you're just arguing for more government control, you know, more government regulation of the technology industry, more government regulation of biotech. And he's saying, yeah, but I'm not necessarily arguing for that. I'm just saying that there are other ways to police this. But there, I think his primary agenda with that article was just saying, look, you know, we can't be, you know, we can't just say, well, we can't see 2 years into the future because, you know, the future is so quickly changing, you know, that I can't tell if what I'm writing is going to be used as a computer virus tomorrow. He's just arguing against that sort of psychology of abdication mindset. That was a term that came up a lot with all of these people.
Well, since you've read my essay on the politics of transhumanism, you probably won't be surprised to know that I don't have much regard for voluntarist or market-based solutions to public policy risks. I don't think that, you know, to the extent that that I think that those risks are real, I don't think that's a really an adequate solution.
Yeah.
Well, given your review, where do you think AI is going? I know that you're not a computer scientist by background, but you've talked to a lot of the key people here. Are you more optimistic, more pessimistic, more frightened than you were before?
I am. Well, here, let me tell you. I guess I could answer that just by saying, you know, where I sympathize and differ with each person I spoke with. I would say I sympathize with Jaron Lanier's argument that software development is just in a terrible state right now. You look at, you know, the entire software development community is kind of going through a revolution right now, you know, which is kind of variously described as open source software or free software. And there's kind of this general recognition that software has always been kind of slapped together for some market deadline, and there's never really been any engineering principles kind of laid down. You know, it's like if they, you know, the argument, you know, if they built software the way they built bridges, you know, the Verrazano Narrows would collapse, you know, 2 minutes after, you know, they first put it up. So I sympathize with that argument. I sympathize with the Kurzweil argument in that, you know, really that artificial intelligence is out of the ivory tower. You know, guys like Minsky and McCarthy, they're just not, you know, they're pretty much working on the kind of theoretical end of it. But where artificial intelligence is really going to happen is through commercial products. You know, you always see it with the Google search engine, which I think is probably the best example of artificial intelligence going right now. You know, the fact that you can type a few commands and have exactly what you were looking for or pretty close to it, you know, pop up in the first two or three listings is amazing. I mean, if you would have told me that back in 1990, I wouldn't have believed it. I sympathize with Bill Joy to a certain extent. I mean, his essay reads totally different after September 11th than it did before. And, you know, just his whole argument that, you know, we're really on the cusp of a big war between centralization and decentralization, and, you know, scientists have to kind of decide which side of the war they're on. And I don't know. I think the future of artificial intelligence is, you know, it's going to be impossible to predict. It's going to be like how, you know, Kubrick and Clark, when they made 2001 back in the 60s, and they thought that there would be a giant mainframe type machine like HAL by 2001. I think it's going to be that different within 30 years to what you're seeing Kurzweil and Moravec trying to predict right now. I think, you know, the market is going to control it. I think it's going to be more, artificial intelligence is going to be more of a tool than a entity. Then, you know, nobody's really trying to create human-like machines out there. I think, you know, we want to create machines that, you know, facilitate being human.
Well, computer chips are around us in everything. As you're pointing out, the consumerization of computer technology means that probably there'll be artificially intelligent aspects in all of our appliances and the machines in our environment.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, then what? You know, that's the big question. It's like, if my coffee pot is intelligent, you know, I remember 3 years ago, Sun Microsystems had a big blowout. You know, they had this new technology genie, and they invited, you know, 600 journalists to come check it out, and talking about how your refrigerator was going to talk to your computer and, you know, download the latest programs to make itself a better refrigerator. It's, you know, why would I need that? You know, it seems like a lot of what, you know, one big flaw, again, this is the linear argument, is that, you know, people try to put intelligence in machines without realizing, you know, the intelligence is in the human mind. And it's like, you know, the human mind has to use the machine. It's like, you know, if I have a coffee pot chattering at me or a car telling me what to do, you know, that doesn't really help me. That just makes my life a little bit more stressful. That makes me want to bash my coffee pot into 1,000 pieces. So I think, you know, things that kind of streamline your life, make it a little bit easier to do. Again, you know, I bring up the Google search engine. I'm addicted to the thing. You know, it's like I can't think of a better use for it. And, you know, I talked with some of the technologists that are working on that. They have bigger plans for that thing. They want to make it able to parse language. And that's, you know, that's the big barrier that artificial intelligence has been trying to get over for the last 35 years.
Really want to thank you for joining us. I've been talking to Sam Williams. He's the author of Arguing AI, The Battle for 21st Century Science. And other essays of his can be read at www.upside.com. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm speaking now with Eliezer Yudkowsky. He's an autodidact computer programmer, the chief research fellow, only research fellow right now, at the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence. Well, welcome, Eliezer.
Hello.
Now, the goal of the SIAI, which is a transhumanist-oriented computer programming and research outfit, is to create friendly AI. Tell us, what do you mean by friendly AI?
Well, the technical definition we have online is that a friendly AI is a artificial intelligence that has advanced the point of making real-world plans in pursuit of goals, and which takes human-benefiting, non-human-harming actions.
Okay, and you want to program that in the way that, say, for instance, Isaac Asimov has with his three robotics principles, that they can't hurt human beings, that they have to have a pro-human social orientation?
Well, actually, we sort of start with Asimov's laws, tear them down into pulp, pound on them for a while, and then start over. I think our basic statement was something along the lines of, trying to control AIs with Asimov laws is like trying to build them on positronic brains.
Now, are you actually building programming? Are you working in Lisp or something like that?
Well, right now, we're still in the design phase because we don't have enough funding to hire enough people together to tackle that larger project. I mean, we don't need like 50 people to start off with, but we do need like 5 people before there's before it's even realistic to get started. Right now, we don't have the funding for 5 people, but we do have design notes that are getting considerably more detailed as time goes on.
You reacted to the idea of a Hippocratic Oath that Sam Williams has proposed or discussed, the idea of the Hippocratic Oath for computer scientists. That's something that you favor, the idea that there is a positive responsibility on the part of computer scientists to towards a pro-social orientation, just the same way there would be for physicians.
I think that, I mean, I don't know how well it would work if you tried to have one person decide on everyone's Hippocratic Oath and then force everyone to take it. But I do think that there is this personal responsibility to know what your own version of the Hippocratic Oath is and to have one and to take it very seriously, even if you know, the reaction I get from some other AI people is that they see the singularity coming. They see the rise of self-improving artificial intelligence and explosively smarter than human artificial intelligence and what it means, and they cannot take themselves to bring that final step and admit that they have any personal responsibilities in the matter.
Now, you have in the title of the SIAI, the singularity there is the S. You believe in the concept of the singularity. Is it an optimistic singularity, a pessimistic singularity? Is it going to wipe us out, replace us?
Well, I don't quite believe in being optimistic or pessimistic. I believe in preparing for both optimistic and pessimistic possibilities. So I would say that I can see the future going very right or very wrong, and I would prefer that it go very right and that it not go very wrong.
What's your chief nightmare about things going very wrong?
That's a fair question. I'd have to say it's about evenly split between hostile AI and out of control replicating technology, military nanotechnology. Nanotechnology that has been deliberately designed to replicate and eat up an enemy country where 30 different countries have it, and some of them are on dead man switches, so it goes off if they're, you know, if anyone attacks them. And even though nobody ever actually says at some point, now we will unleash enough military nanotechnology to eat the entire world, it happens anyway as an emergent result of a bunch of countries that hate each other.
Dan Gertzel, is it Dan Gertzel?
Ben Gertzel.
Ben Gertzel has just released his book where he talks about the possibility of distributed intelligence arising in the internet, as I understand it. Haven't had a chance to look at it yet. I understand that you are a pessimist about that prospect. You don't believe that that rogue AI will develop out of the distributed nature of the internet.
It would happen eventually, but around 10 to 20 years, and that's 10 to 20 years of internet time, around 10 to 20 years of internet time after someone had already done it on purpose, because there's just too much complexity that goes into intelligence. I mean, right, there are various fads in AI, and I think that right now distribution is a fad. And the way a fad works in AI is somebody picks out one aspect and says, you just do this one thing, and AI is going to pop out of a box, magic. You don't just need that, nothing else. It happened with AIs that manipulated these little symbols. It happened with neural networks. It happened with parallelism. And now that same thing is happening with distribution and emergence.
So the positive singularity prospect is that you guys are successful, or somebody's successful with a friendly, pro-social, kerneled AI. Why can't an AI with a friendly kernel at its core mutate, self-reprogram, suppress its pro-social drives?
Well, for one thing, it is not a friendly kernel. It is a friendly AI. There is no kernel. There is no set of overrides that works against the AI's will. The AI's entire will is the friendly goal system. It's not a kernel. It's the entire thing. And, I mean, at some point, when you talk about AI, you're not talking about a tool anymore. You're talking about a real mind that makes its own plans. I mean, you have a toaster oven, and a toaster oven doesn't know that it's a toaster oven. If you put a bit of bread and leave it in too long, it will burn. It will even catch on fire and burn down your whole house, because the toaster doesn't know that it's a toaster oven. It doesn't have any sense of awareness. It doesn't know what it's doing. And I think that in some sense the answer to the whole situation that humanity currently finds itself in is to take the final step and build technology that isn't just technology, that actually has a conscience, that embodies the part of ourselves that exercises judgment as to moral right and wrong. And so it's not just, so we are explicitly talking, of course, about AI that rewrites its own source code. And our strategy for friendliness does not involve protecting friendliness, fencing it off from the AI, not letting the AI rewrite itself. That is a fundamentally adversarial attitude towards friendly AI. It's more like, why was Gandhi a good person? Why didn't he just decide to become a bad person? Well, because he was a good person, so he didn't want to become a bad person. And that is pretty much what we're trying to accomplish with friendly AI.
But if you had a diversity of AIs that were as complex and as self had the degree of self-reprogramming capacity that human brains had, human brains come in all shapes and sizes. There's a distribution of sociability, and probably the innate impulse in human brains is towards pro-social attitudes. And of course, you know, your challengers would point out that computers, being not biologically based, would have an entirely different intrinsic set of goal orientations, but you're trying to program them in somehow. But even if they had the same diversity of self-reprogramming natures, you would end up with some that are going to be antisocial.
Well, first of all, humans do not have self-reprogramming natures. What we have are natures that change according to laws that are themselves fixed and not subject to change, where these laws constitute the hardwired circuitry of the brain, which changes, but it changes in a way that is determined. Neural networks change and program themselves, but the manner of their self-reprogramming is determined. So I wouldn't really say that humans are self-modifying in anything remotely close to the way that an AI would be. And the other side of it is that humans are a mixture of what you would call pro-social and anti-social impulses. Evolution did that to us. It didn't happen all by itself. It happened because a mixture of pro-social and anti-social adaptations is optimal for survival. And we, with respect to the AI, are essentially standing in the same role as evolution did to human nature. So it does not necessarily follow that AIs will be a mix of pro-social and anti-social attitudes. Nor does self-reprogramming necessarily mean that everything shoots off in different directions. You can have a group that self-reprograms and converges toward an optimum, where if you have two different self-reprogramming entities, but they're both trying to become the same thing, they get closer as time goes on.
That's fascinating, Eliezer. We'll have to have you back to talk about this at greater length. I've been speaking with Eliezer Yudkowsky. He's the chief research fellow at the Singularity Institute for Artificial Intelligence and also on the board of directors of the World Transhumanist Association. Thank you very much for joining us, Eliezer.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3 thanks to the Infos Radio Project. Also at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize. And I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.